So it's July 13th, 2016. I'm Rick Hansen, and I wanted to continue with you what we talked about 2 weeks ago, which in the larger frame in the sitting group of exploring the Buddhist teachings about mindfulness and their practical applications today, and, you know, to the extent it's useful, some understanding of some of the underlying neural correlates or neuropsychological aspects of all this. In that larger context, the Buddha's four foundations or four major places to develop mindfulness, being the body, second, the hedonic tone of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Third, you know, your general state of mind. You know, are you in the red zone or the green zone, as I might put it? And then the fourth application of mindfulness is to a variety of themes in the teachings in the Buddhist tradition. In that larger framework, we've just started to move into mindfulness of what can be translated as the feeling tone of experience, or probably more clearly translated as the hedonic tone of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Because it's not so much about the emotions or feelings we're having, but the sense of things as being, you know, I like it, I don't like it, I don't care, you know, right? Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So that's where we started. Last time when I was here 2 weeks ago, we had a guest teacher last week, Lee Lesser, I believe, wonderful guest teacher. Will Pai, blessed with by a brain tumor. That's it. I'd be okay skipping that blessing myself, but anyway, we'll see what happens. Will certainly grew enormously from it. Anyway, so I want to start exploring with you the feeling tone of experience, and in particular the unpleasant feeling tone, partly because I think it's likely that that was the first hedonic tone that evolved, because first and foremost, our ancient ancestors needed to get away from what was dangerous or disgusting. And it's probably true that the first emotions that evolved were versions of fear, anger, and disgust. Lust probably might have come even a little later. So I want to talk now about things that are unpleasant. And the obvious example of it is immediate physical pain. You know, you drop a brick on your foot, you stub your toe, or you have some kind of chronic physical pain, as many, many people do, including in my larger family system. And that is a very clear example of that which is unpleasant. Then there are more everyday examples, such as, you know, the worry that comes up when, you know, your doctor gives you those four words you never want to hear, that doesn't look good, right? I've heard that twice in my life. And it all turned out okay, but it's naturally kind of alarming. Or the unpleasantness of, you know, in our hallway at home, like probably a lot of families, we sort of line it with pictures of our kids growing up. They're now 28 and 26, and I'll walk down that hallway and I'll see these pictures. You know, our daughter riding on a little sheep in this hippie B&B in Canada we stayed at when they were young. She was about 10 years old. Or our son laughing or being, you know, playful in a swimming pool also when he was about 10. And that's a long time ago. That's past. It's never going to come back. And there's a poignance, you know, there's a poignance, particularly for social creatures such as ourselves. You walk down the hallway, it just touches your heart. Or you in the news, you know, you hear about something terrible, people getting shot or killed in any one of a terrible variety of ways. And it gets you, and that's unpleasant too. Then the Buddha was very interested in what happens next, because part of his great journey himself in his practice was to explore what he came to call the middle way, in which we're not denying what's unpleasant or denying what's pleasant, but we're finding a way to relate to unpleasant or relate to what's pleasant or neutral, or I would add as well, heartfelt, that which is very relational with other people, to find a way to relate to all that that doesn't involve craving and clinging and suffering and harm, but instead a fundamental quality of freedom and happiness. There's actually a quotation. I'd like to read to you as context here from the Buddha's own journey. Let's see here. Right. So this is from the book Satipatthana, Four Foundations of Mindfulness, or the Establishments of Mindfulness. And there are handouts for the central teachings here that you're very welcome to get and bring here as we explore this year, or just forget them and pick up another one. It's really okay. But anyway, so I'm reading this from this is from the German monk Analio, who has an amazing command of English. And this is a paragraph I'd like to read you. Said, after his awakening, the Buddha declared himself to be one who lived in happiness. In other words, the end of suffering is not a big blank. It's happiness. This statement clearly shows that, unlike some of his ascetic contemporaries, the Buddha was no longer afraid of pleasant feelings. As he pointed out, it was precisely the successful eradication of all mental unwholesomeness that caused his happiness and delight. In a similar vein, the verses composed by awakened people often extol the happiness of freedom gained through the successful practice of the path. The presence of delight and joy among those who are awakened, the awakened students of the Buddha, often found its expression in poetic descriptions of natural beauty. Indeed, the early participants in the Buddhist path delighted in their way of life, as testified by a visiting king, who described them as, quote, smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful and plainly delighting, living at ease and unruffled. This description forms part of a comparison made by the king between the followers of the Buddha and other ascetics whose demeanor was comparatively gloomy. To him, the king, the degree of joy exhibited by the Buddha's disciples corroborated the appropriateness of the Buddha's teaching. These passages document the significant role of joy, wholesome joy, in the life of the early Buddhist community. So it's in that context that we're exploring how we react to the flavors of experience moment to moment. So we have the raw experience of the moment, which can sometimes be unpleasant, and then there's what follows after, our reactions to it. And then we react to those reactions and react to those reactions, and then other people's reactions to our reactions to their reactions, and round it goes. And so I want to illustrate this with a little recent story involving my long-suffering topic of many stories, my wife. So anyway, so there's the story. So we were together on Sunday. Hanging out, and I was cooking something. I ended up cooking this pot roast, and the critically important part is I was going to roast some squash, okay? And so there were these pieces of squash on a tray, and you know the recipe is you splatter them with olive oil and salt and pepper, and then you stick them in the oven. Okay, fine. So there I was, just kind of doing my thing, and I started splashing the squash with olive oil. And my wife said, with some alarm, what are you doing? And I got alarmed at her alarm. What do you mean, what am I doing? You know? And whoop, round it went from there. And so anyway, it wasn't a horrible thing. You know, no plates were broken. No permanent damage was done. But it was like, it was one of those spirals, okay? And I remembered, of course, that it was probably at least the fourth time, who's counting? Me. Anyway, for the last couple hours where she had given me some kind of correction about what I was doing in life, and you know how much I like that. And, you know, and to her, I was just clearly going off the rails all day long, too exuberant, too loose, too uncontrolled, and so all that was right there in how much olive oil you put on squash, you know? And I'm sure gender socialization and patriarchy and late-stage capitalism was in there as well somewhere. So, but there it was, the whole typical mess, right? And so it's very interesting, if you just kind of slow it down, and one of the wonderful things about mindfulness is it helps you kind of come more into what I call a granularity with real time. You start being able to slow it down, you see more mental events per minute or even per second. But, you know, initially often in retrospect, you kind of create the instant replay of the weird little tiff you just had with your partner. Like, why are we arguing about, you know, how much olive oil we're putting on squash on either side, you know? And then also in real time, you can catch yourself faster. You know, there's this great line from Viktor Frankl, you probably know it, founder of logotherapy, Holocaust survivor. He says essentially, between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies our freedom. And training in mindfulness helps us live more in that space or come back to that space after we've been hijacked by our reactions, you know, more quickly and accomplish repairs as appropriate. I was repairing for the last several days now, you know, as appropriate for what happens. So in that moment, it's very interesting. You can just see it. So there's a stimulus, you know, olive oil splattered on squash. And then in my wife's mind, there was some quality of alarm, right? So even though it's not inherently unpleasant, it became unpleasant for her. And that's often the case. It's actually not inherently unpleasant. It's not inherently unpleasant for some guy driving a big black Cadillac wearing a hat to cut in front of me in the freeway. You know what I mean? It's just the way it is. But we often add unpleasantness to things that are actually not intrinsically unpleasant. So that part. And then there's sort of the priming that led to that. We were getting irritable with each other. You know, I was a little out of control. She was a little controlling. A little this, a little that. Nothing said over the course of the Sunday together. Lips tightening a little bit. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
If you've ever been in a relationship with anyone more than 36 hours, you probably know what I'm talking about, let alone more than 36 years in our case. So she was primed. Very important point. We get kind of ahead of steam, right? We, you know, it's like one little firecracker after another that we throw on the ground. And then the match lands, and it's like a big pile of dynamite. Individually little things, you get kind of revved up. This is especially true around the unpleasant. It's kind of less true around the pleasant or the neutral. You get kind of aggravated over the course of the day. In the back of your mind, you're building up your case about the other person. Or, you know, you're tired, you're hungry, stuff's building up. And then kaboom, the trigger lands. Okay. So then, and I think she would say, yeah, that was what was happening pretty much in her mind. Then comes this to me, right? And you could say that that kind of bit of flaring or alarm or sort of critical control, you know, wasn't a vulnerable request. It was a critical demand. There's a huge distinction there in relationships. You know, I'm going to write a piece soon, a short piece, called Make Vulnerable Requests, not, you know, instead of rather critical demands. And I think that's such a key distinction in relationships. So it came at me that way. If it had been earlier in the day, I just would have rolled with it. You know, I might have said something that was slightly autonomy reestablishing, like, okay, sure, you know, or something like that, some little tone of voice or something, but it wouldn't have tipped, but it tipped for me because I had been building up a head of steam and I had gotten fed up at one little thing after another of, you know, needless, in my view, of course, criticism or control or fault-finding coming at me. And speaking of priming, then, of course, there's our childhood. Personally, I grew up in a fault-finding home. And most of the fault-finding was really unnecessary. And often it had a kind of craziness to it. And often it had a motivated quality to it, my own family of origin, in which it's like you could feel the tension rising as my mother or father kept scanning for something wrong, right? You know, they were searching for something wrong and they were uneasy because they didn't know what it was yet. And that's what really was alarming for them. And as soon as they spotted it in one of the three kids they had, I was the oldest of three, boom, you know, tension dissipated in their minds, right? Tension acquired in the minds of their children, right? So that too, kind of ahead of steam, you know what I mean? Right, okay. So then the thing lands, the little stimulus lands, and then we have our reaction to it. And then your reaction takes on a life of itself, doesn't it? You get, you know, you get alarmed. It's like a threat coming at you. It's shocking initially, boom, like that. Sometimes, you know, anxiety-provoking stimuli sort of come very slowly, you know, but often they come at us and we're startled or alarmed or shocked or, you know, rattled, or we don't know quite what to do. And then the cortisol is released, the adrenaline's released, the heart's pounding faster. And when we're activated in that way, hormonally and in terms of the sympathetic wing of the autonomic nervous system, we are designed, when the waters are really rising in that way, we're primed to interpret events negatively, right? Which then creates creates a vicious cycle, which then makes us more irritated, more calms, you know. My wife says that to me, I flare myself. She's startled by my flare. It seems completely out of proportion to, you know, whatever was excessive about her criticism of how much oil I'm putting on the squash, right? And then I can't believe that she doesn't understand why she was such an asshole, you know that moment, right? And then I'm just swept away. And then when she's swept away, and then we feed each other, round and round you go, right? Caught in unpleasant. Ring any bells? So, I don't know. Okay, so it all ended well. It's okay, you know, we're okay. But it was really striking. Like so many situations, obviously there are terrible things that happen under the heading of unpleasantness. And in the Buddhist time, 2,500 years ago, you know, pre-modern, essentially, you know, feudal society, agrarian, pre-literate mainly, no regulation of pain in particular, dreadful things happening, wars, slavery, profound mistreatment of women and people kind of in the underclasses of the time. There was a lot of harsh, intense, unpleasant. These days, you know, in the majority of the world, unfortunately not the entirety of the world, there's fairly good regulation of pain, there's, you know, fairly good provision of basic supplies. And so most of the unpleasantness that people do experience is interpersonal or subtle or messy in the way I've described, but it's no less suffering. We're no less lost to true nature when we're arguing with our spouse about how much olive oil to put on stupid squash, you know, rather than writhing in agonizing pain. We're still, boom, we're still sucked in that moment. So what does the Buddha offer about that? Okay, we're going to explore unpleasantness for a while. Hopefully it'll be a pleasant exploration of the unpleasant. And then we'll segue into chasing the pleasant, you know, grasping after, including addictive kinds of processes. And we'll also explore in the weeks ahead, you know, what to do about the neutral and also the heartfelt. But I'm going to focus for a little bit, you know, for certainly in the next few weeks, on the territory of the unpleasant, which in a practical sense includes fear and anger and helplessness. Okay? That's kind of the territory of unpleasant that has to do with safety. We'll also explore frustration, loss, disappointment. That's the territory of the unpleasant, having to do with our needs for satisfaction, approaching rewards, broadly defined. And we'll explore, to some extent, the territory of hurt or resentment or feelings of loneliness or inadequacy, also unpleasant, having to do with our needs for connection, achieved through attaching in healthy and good ways with other people. Okay, so that's kind of the territory, right? It's a lot of stuff there and a lot of suffering there. So the Buddha's main advice in his teachings about mindfulness, which are not the entirety of his teachings, okay, but it's a major piece of that, are summarized in this refrain. It's called, that I'll read to you here, which is the stance really of really just being with what's there, witnessing it with insight. He says, essentially, that what we should do is abide contemplating the hedonic tones of experience, contemplating things as pleasant, unpleasant, heartfelt, or neutral, and not reacting to them. Because in the sequence that flows, psychologically flows in the wisdom traditions of Buddhism and flows neuropsychologically from stimulus to bare perception of it, to the sense of it as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, to resisting the unpleasant, chasing the pleasant, and wanting the neutral to hurry up and get happy. That's when suffering begins. It's that tipping point. Make sense? So growing the inner shock absorber in real time. If I'd been really on my ball, you know, I would have noticed what my wife was saying. I would have noticed the initial kind of inherent shock of it. And then I would have just watched my mind manufacture all kinds of unpleasantness that was not inherent in what happened. There were no huge stakes on the table. You know, she wasn't attacking me with a frying pan. How dare you put so much olive oil on my squash? You know, she wasn't ugly, it wasn't nasty, right? I constructed, I manufactured, I added, my mind added, tons and tons of unnecessary, needless unpleasantness. You know, if I'd been really right there in real time, you know, in the 1.5 seconds it took to get pretty irritated, you know, I would have been able to have more of a shock absorber. So we practice, right? So that increasingly, as Upandita put it, we expand the range of experiences in which we can be free. And to flag a key point we'll be getting at to in future weeks, really tracking the priming. In retrospect, that was my big blunder. I wasn't tracking how I was getting a little fed up, you know? Right? It's like, yeah. And, okay. So, the Buddha says, we should abide, so he says basically, how should you abide in contemplation? Well, he says, am I here? Here we go. In this way, in regard to the feeling tones of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, in real time, you should abide contemplating these hedonic tones or feeling tones of experience internally, inside yourself. Or abide contemplating them externally in other people. Not trying to mind read or play therapist on them, but just witnessing them, being mindful of the rise and flow, ebb and flow, the rise and fall of hedonic tones in other people. Or abide contemplating these hedonic tones of experience that are so natural, both internally and externally. Or you can abide contemplating the nature of arising in feeling tones, or abide contemplating the nature of passing away of feeling tones. So you're tracking their impermanence. You're watching things get unpleasant, and then you're watching the unpleasantness of things pass away. When we're in the middle of it, feeling unpleasant, it seems eternal, like it'll never end. You know, it's just this. But actually, as I was joking earlier, as a surgeon once told me, all bleeding stops eventually, Rick, one way or another. You know, right? It is a passing away, so in most cases. Or you can abide contemplating the nature of both arising and passing away of the hedonic tones of experience. Or mindfulness, simply that there are feeling tones, can be established in you to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And in this way, you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. Okay? So basically what the Buddha is recommending in this form of practice, there are other forms of practice where a person in terms of his recommendations, more actively engages fear and anger, ill will, frustration, disappointment, hurt, resentment, aggressive feelings toward other people, and all the rest of that. I'll be getting into that, and I think that's where there's a very fruitful intersection around neurodharma of the teachings of, in the contemplative traditions and 2,500 years, especially the last 100 or so years, especially the last 10 years, of emergence of science over time. But meanwhile, let's just focus here on pure mindfulness as a stance or as a practice with what's unpleasant. So he's talking about recognizing when the unpleasant is there, and also recognizing it in other people and in both yourself and in other people in kind of a dynamic, interdependent way, as in the story of the squash and my wife. Okay, recognize it. Be aware of it. That's the first, that's 50%. For me as a longtime therapist, that's half of it, self-awareness, just recognizing it in real time. You know, oh, this is unpleasant. Oh, these are my reactions to the unpleasant. Oh, okay. Second, you can track not just the unpleasantness itself as an experience, but how it kind of arises. What gives rise to it? Where did it come from? You know, what were its causes? And you can also be mindful of its passing away. Oh, interesting, it does fade. This pain changes, this feeling shifts. You know, this revved upness and the heat of red hot anger gradually calms down eventually. Oh, that's interesting. Or you can just simply abide very centered in your ongoing mindfulness, aware that in the tapestry of experience, you know, every so often then there are some fairly distinct threads that have to do with the sense of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. What I myself, finishing up here, and then want to see what you think about all this, what I myself really appreciate about that stance of bear witnessing, in effect, right, is that it's our, in a way, ultimate refuge. Because oftentimes, there's nothing else you can do. It's really unpleasant. It's sometimes terrible. Extraordinary pain, terrible loss, compassionate outrage at what's happening to other people. It's just overwhelming. But at least we can be mindful in the midst of that overwhelm. At least for me, it's kind of like mindfulness is this buoy we hold on to in the ocean. Sometimes the waves, you know, sometimes the ocean of consciousness and reality is very placid, you know. Other times the waves really come, and then sometimes it's a force 28 whatever hurricane, you know, rocketing through. And it's our prior training in mindfulness, our daily practice perhaps, weekly practice here. It's our training that then enables us to stay in touch with this buoy, this refuge, in the midst of the waves, you know, no matter how big they are. Okay. All right. What's your squash story? Or what do you make of this? Yeah, and we're entering into this topic. Great, please.
Thank you so much for your story. I'd like to say a couple quick things. So first of all, so I teach mindfulness to my leadership clients, and I am frequently given a big dose of humility when I find myself in my own squash story.
Yeah.
And I just think, I teach this stuff.
Right.
And then my partner will do something, and I will observe my reaction and then watch how I just can't resist saying, you should listen to me. Why would you do that? I told you to do this. And then I'll say, I'm sorry, I just had to say that. That's my work. And I try to practice a balance of compassion for myself, it's all learning, and respect for my partner who's my teacher, and really make it a quest to let all of those situations be a constant reminder of, you know, how do we learn and practice this? And it really is a practice.
Oh, thank you. That's great. And so real, I can relate.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I'd like to add and invite is, I've been feeling an enormous amount of pain since last week with all these racial issues. I mean, as though it were my personal responsibility to do something. And I think that I was going to say leaders, but it isn't even just our leaders, those who are really trying to offer mindfulness, and I think the big message is try to understand the other person's perspective. Even one of the victims, you know, his son was on the news this morning and saying, let's not practice violence. Let's let what happened to my dad be a way that we can teach. Let's try to understand how others are feeling, whether it's policemen or black people or people with guns or whatever, you know, whatever it is. And so in some ways I feel like this is more needed now than it's ever felt to me, but see it for myself and for the healing of the world.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. By the way, I'm going to turn the lights up just a smidge, because it'd be nice to see your faces a little more clearly. Where am I here?
There you are.
There we go. That okay? I wish we had like a campfire in here. I just feel like sitting around, you know, sharing with each other.
Just to the floor.
I know. I think Dominican might not like that, but yeah, please. Yeah.
Okay. So I've been a part of some spiritual communities where there's been a lot of conflict.
Uh-huh.
And then the one I'm in now, they talked about this process, agreeing to disagree in love.
Mm.
And I Googled it, and there's some great stuff on that process. And the first part of it is just accepting the conflict as part of being human.
Yeah.
And expecting it and not being thrown off the rack.
Yeah.
And then the next step, of course, is praying and grounding, calming down. But the third step is going directly to the person. And in the conflict you had with your wife, you're both trained psychologists, right? So you can still communicate when you calm down, right?
She's a talented amateur. I didn't mean that negatively. I mean like me about health, you know. But no, she's more of a body worker kind of person. Kind of a person, yeah. That's
so
right.
I found it work in spiritual communities.
We're all psychologists. Some of us get paid for it, you know. Anyway, that's what I mean. Yeah.
So you try to get to the person sometimes, because that's the big part of it, not gossiping.
Yeah.
And they stonewall you.
Yeah.
So there's just this incredible angst, because how can you resolve anything when somebody won't talk to you about it?
And, yeah.
You know, there's a big blow up, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of pain. So what's the Buddhist thinking on dealing with that pain from a lack of communication, a lack of resolve? And sometimes things stay unresolved for days, months, years, decades, right?
It's a great example, and what's really great is to zero in, much as the Buddha says, what exactly is unpleasant here? And what I think you'll discover, and I've observed this many times myself, is initially it seems to me that the whole package is unpleasant, right? Or the situation is unpleasant. And as we'll get to more, there's often a narrative about it in my mind that kind of turns it into one sludgy mass that is wrong in some way, bad, shouldn't be like this. But if you look more closely, you kind of pull apart the threads of the experience. And you go, what exactly is unpleasant in being stonewalled? Okay, I'm being stonewalled, whatever. They won't talk to me. They won't repair. I really want to repair here. They won't repair. They won't reply. They won't do it. You know, it makes it worse even. It just gets weirder if I try to talk about stuff, right? Okay. All right, so that's the fact. What exactly is the unpleasantness of that fact? And then you look closely in your own experience. What exactly is the unpleasant feeling in this body? You know? And what starts to happen is you begin to realize that most of your experience of the situation, like the mosaic of your experience of the situation or relationship, which has so many parts, only a few of those tiles are actually painful of the total mosaic of the experience of the situation or relationship. There's a lot of other stuff involved. And so what you start seeing is there's the unpleasantness that seems kind of inherent. You know, for us as social animals or as physical, we have bodies. It's kind of inherently unpleasant. And then there's all this other stuff that's added to it. And you start separating that out and disidentifying from that other stuff that's added to it. And it's not so unpleasant, and you start having a lot more control over your own reactions. So that inquiry, you know, really going really into the detail of what was actually unpleasant here, or what is actually unpleasant here, and what else is happening that's not actually unpleasant. That's powerful. Yeah, please.
I'm from far away, so I don't risk much.
Okay.
I'm teasing.
Okay. You're from far away, so you don't risk much. Okay. Yeah.
So this year I've been working with the ending of a 20-year relationship. And I didn't know why for a long time.
And are you able to speak a little louder? Otherwise, I'll have to repeat what you say, and that'll be hard.
And I didn't know why it was ending. I mean, there was a lot but that we'd both contributed to, but there wasn't a lot of dialogue. There was a lot of stonewalling. And about 3 weeks ago, I found out there was someone else for about a few years. Mm-hmm. And so I've been very angry.
Yeah.
But when I tried to figure out what I was angry about, mostly, it was how much I filled the negative space with the bad object of me. Does that make sense?
Why don't you unpack the language you're using, the terms for everyone?
Like
the space, the bad object.
When there's silence, especially like between me and my partner, and I was trying to get him to talk and explain, and he wouldn't, and I have 3 marbles and he's got the rest, and holding him. I spent the year like looking at what did I do? I was so bad at this, I was a horrible this and that, and like the whole year. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I didn't do all that, but there was also, takes two. And I was so frustrated with myself because, well, at first I was mad at him for letting me sit with it for so long, mm-hmm. but then I realized I filled that space with, mm-hmm. I just took it and went with all the bad aspects of my psyche that I let take over a lot. And so I'd rather not do that.
Thank you for sharing that. And I mean, to be clear, just you're not saying that when you talked about filling the space, as it were, you mean with your own imagination and self-criticism, and you know, you're feeling bad about yourself. One of the most poignant, heart-wrenching things our son ever said to us soon after his sister came along, and we'd been letting him, you know, watch too many movies or the electronic babysitter, you know, that involved like bad soldiers. He said, "Mommy, I feel like a bad soldier." Like he'd internalized that. It was like, that was one clue that we needed to change course and how we were doing our family after his sister came along. And so it's sometimes we feel like a bad soldier or a bad partner, perhaps wife, you know, right? And you're talking about that. That doesn't, of course, justify whatever the other people do. You're talking about your own psychological process, right?
It's a pattern that I notice that I do with an empty space.
That's so interesting to add like a negative self-view, right? Into a space of possibility.
The person isn't offering their half of it or isn't saying, okay, well, here's mine as well. It's just, it's easy to do. I don't think I'm alone in it, but.
No.
Not at all.
Yeah. Wow. Do you know why you do that?
Family history.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got 8 years of therapy. I'm working on
it. I don't know if this is at all true for you, but sometimes, like, emptiness can feel unpleasant. You know, like there's just silence or a space, right? Or not knowing, right? And so, like for my parents, not knowing what the fault was as they kept scanning for it was for them more alarming than actually discovering what was wrong. You know, it was like a space and they would fill it. And I think it's interesting sometimes that just like things being unresolved or, you know, or it's like there's an emptiness there or an openness, you know, that itself can feel negative to us. It can feel unpleasant to us. And then we want to do something about it. One of the things that's difficult for me to tolerate is incomplete cycles. You know, I had a therapy client once who teased me because I would like put my pad on my desk near her and I would straighten it so it match the corners. I have at least one of the 10 genes for OCD, I'm sure. But anyway, and she jiggled my pad It's like, how dare you touch my yellow pad? But she knew me really well. She was messing with me, and it was a good thing. You know what I mean? Right? And so we have, it's interesting to track as well, like the things that are personally unpleasant for you, potentially including like a space, you know, to fill. I think there's also a lot more in what you're saying that I'm not fully on top of right here, but I'll just leave it at that for now, maybe. Yeah. Okay, so let's kind of move to a finish for tonight. My encouragement to you is to track, as the Buddha recommends, as much as you can in real time, when pleasant is there. Think of it as your pleasant, unpleasantometer, you know? Is the needle moving at all? Like, what's happening? Right? And then, if you can, look more closely at it and see if you can separate what's inherently unpleasant, what the Buddha called the first dart of life, from all the stuff we add afterward, which he called the second darts of life, the stuff we add to a situation. Make sense, right? And then I want to just offer three practical suggestions, which I'll be exploring in the weeks to come. The first is watch the priming. You know, the impact of this odd, weird silence, you know, as the months go by, or in my case with the squash story, the feeling increasingly aggrieved that, you know, I'm just being put upon, how dare you, and whatever, you know. For my wife, who knows what, you know, I'm sure 100% deservedly I was irritating in various ways over the course of the day, right? Whatever. What's the priming? So that's a very first practical thing. So in addition to just witnessing, which is what the Buddha's talking about, recognition of your priming, how you get revved up. Okay. Third suggestion is to track the narrative, the story. Oh man, did I have a narrative. I had like a Supreme Court brief in about 2 seconds, fully formed in my mind. I have a talent. About my wife's critique of me. Like, you see what I mean? Just watch the narrative and the meanings we give to things and the intentions we attribute to other people. That's really key, tracking the intentions we attribute to other people. And then the fourth practical suggestion, which I'll get to in the days to come, is love. The Buddha really emphasized love and loving kindness. That emphasis has been lost or downplayed in a lot of the movement of Buddhism through China, Japan, and then into the West. But it's really central to his teachings, and he particularly recommended it for our reactions of aversion to what's unpleasant. You know, aversion is what we add to what's unpleasant, right? And the Buddha taught that loving kindness and pervading in all directions without omitting anything, you know, that kind of quality of lovingness is a wonderful healing. It kind of cools the fires of fear and anger. Okay, those, got it? Observing, right? Track the priming, getting revved up. Three, you know, be skeptical of the story, the narrative, the meaning, the interpretations, the perspectives, the framing. And four, remember to love. Okay. We'll see you next week. All right, so let's sit for one more minute. No. Okay? Let's sit for a minute. Just let it sink in. Take good care.